Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, permanently archived when we're done with each book, at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to pick up The Nation of Islam, the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, and conclude the portion from page 107 to 140, The Trial of Leo Frank, so the back section of that. It's not divided by chapters, so it's just sections. And we started with the trial of Leo Frank last time, and now we'll conclude. So let's dig in to this fascinating piece of American history that really was a turning point for blacks, whites, and Jews, as Jews essentially pivoted onto a fresh set of lies. Before, they had masqueraded as white to gain the social mobility and status. And after this case, they played it as though they were the blacks' best friend, even though they had dominated the slave trade, and not only the slave trade, but dominated the markets for the products slaves produced. So we pick up on page 107 with a new subsection, Leo Frank's Sexual Catastrophe. Epigraph. Frank had about as much a chance as crippled grasshoppers in a pen of doves. Nice figure from Luther Z. Rosser, the goy who was deputed basically to lead the trial by the Jew defense team and Jew money behind their man, Leo Frank. To the courtroom observers and the jury of 12 men, Conley's story finally made sense of the murder and severely restricted the defense's courtroom options. So this is the sweeper, Jim Conley, who was set up at the base of the steps by the Jew Leo Frank many times, including the day Mary Fagan was murdered, to allow him to carry on his assignations or his attempted seductions in private. And then he'd stamp his foot or whistle, and the girl would be let back out, and no one would be able to see what was going on, because this 29-year-old Jew Leo Frank was married to a Jew and head of the B'nai B'rith in Atlanta. But his real love and fun and pastime was seducing goy girls, and not women, literally girls. And this Mary Fagan, when she was murdered, was 13 years old, when she was murdered, raped, and tortured by this nasty little homunculus from Cornell, Leo Max Frank. To effectively refute any of Connolly's story would require that Leo Frank himself be placed on the stand, since nearly all of what Conley described took place in Frank's presence. So again, we've had the best, highest priced defense the money can buy in an era in which blacks are looked down upon as basically the niggers they are, and hence their words are not respected. And we have a black going directly against what they call a white, which is actually a Jew, and the Jew is giving all indications that he's afraid to face the person accusing him. And all people agree that mere black sweeper, that is janitor, James Jim Conley's testimony is very plausible. They believe it. So they take, for perhaps the first time in history, the word of a black over a white sick Jew. So now that's the point we're at. Conley's come off the trial, and he was up on the stand for like 16 hours. And did an excellent job. He was persuasive to everybody. So, to refute him, they're going to need to put Leo Frank on the stand. But the risk was obvious. It would open Frank up to the kind of blistering cross-examination under oath that he and his attorneys had been assiduously avoiding. If Frank refused to confront, quote, the Negro Conley, unquote, in a jailhouse, even with his lawyer present, he certainly wanted no part of the state's top prosecutors confronting him in an open court with a long, long list of unexplained facts and behaviors. That placed Leo Frank's defenders in a position where they had to de-emphasize the details, promote Frank's superior social standing, and appeal to the 12 white jurors on the basis of that holiest of holy American traditions, white supremacy. There was no one better prepared for that task than Georgia's own legal legend, Luther Z. Rosser. When Rosser sidled up to his black prey, Leo Frank and his supporters prayed that it was only a matter of time before Connally collapsed under the anticipated battering. Rosser eased into his task with a preliminary spelling test to showcase Connally's intellectual deficiencies. So this is going to be a page of Q&A, or Q mostly, but some A. Q, can you read newspapers? A, not much. I read them some. Do you read them often? I pick them up now and then. What do you read? Little words like this and that. They are pretty common words in the newspapers, aren't they? Yes. Can you spell school? Yes. Color? No. Shirt? Yes. Cat? Yes. Do you spell it with a K or with a C? Answer, with a K. Can you spell mother? No. Can you spell papa? Yes. How? P-A-P-A. Can you spell day? Yes. Daylight? Yes. Can you spell beer? Yes. Can you spell whiskey? No. Look at this picture and tell me if you can read any of these words. No. Do you know your figures? Yes. You know a good deal more about figures than you do about spelling, don't you? Yes, I can count better than I can spell, says Connally. Then you are better at figuring than you are at writing. Yes, I am better at counting. Well, isn't figuring counting? I don't know. You don't know you are 27 years old, do you, Jim? Yes, sir, that's what my mother said. The Atlanta Journal, or the Atlanta Constitutions, which was later folded with the journal, or the journal was folded in, I believe, is the paper you'd see today in 2017 when I'm reading this. The Atlanta Constitution's courtroom reporter described the scene. Jim's face showed that he could not see what in the world a great big white man with the knowledge of Luther Rosser could want to take up in the time in court to go into a spelling bee with him for. The white man and the darkie had reached a perfect understanding, such as a white man and a Negro have when they are raised together on the same big plantation. But that was as far as Rosser was able to, quote-unquote, break down the witness. Connally's vocabulary may have been limited, but his powers of recall were exceptional, and his account of the murder remained unshaken. He soon forced Rosser into an agitated retreat. The defense attorney made a mystifying series of blunders that would place his client deeper and deeper in irreversible legal jeopardy. Rosser's line of questioning focused the witness on the role he had claimed to play as, quote, lookout, while Frank committed infidelities at the factory. And to everyone's astonishment, Rosser walked Connally directly into revealing the most damaging aspects of Leo Frank's character. And this is going to be that he's done this shit before. This is not his first rodeo. He asked his witness, Rosser did, about the next time you watch for Frank, what time of day did you inquire who the woman was? Now, the next time was Thanksgiving, wasn't it? Where were you when she arrived? What time did the woman come? Did you know her? Now, what they're saying is the defense attorney should have realized that, like, A, all this shit did happen. B, it evinces a clear pattern of behavior. So what he hoped to achieve by bringing any of this stuff out is very far from clear. Basically, he has the most difficult case of all to work. He has nothing on his side except that Connally didn't literally see Frank do it, but yet, apart from speculating on some other unknown person that nobody else saw doing the crime, it had to be Leo Frank because he and Connally were the only ones there on that second floor. So basically, he has an indefensible case. The race at all doesn't matter. Unless the Connally completely falls apart, there really isn't any other way. I mean, the girl's dead. She was alive. She clearly came in there at 12, and she clearly didn't come out. So something happened. You see, it's basically not a defensible case, so I wouldn't get too worked up over how good or bad the defense was. But it's still a little odd that he's walking. He's asking all these details about stuff that is going to do nothing but tell people that, yeah, this guy did this kind of stuff all the time. Now, a lot of those women either yielded to his advances or they were prepared to have fun with him when they came in. I mean, that may have been a legitimate thing. It was still adultery, but it was at least consensual. Whereas this time, this girl had never yielded to him, and he didn't know what the outcome would be. It was just he was more trying, and she rejected him, and he got angry. But the pattern of using private time guarded by a black to assignate with various women, tryst or rendezvous with them, was established, and his own defense is not defending him. It's not helping him at all by getting into any of this. Atlanta stood aghast at the spectacle as Conley used every opening to relay in mortifying detail five other instances where he had acted as Frank's lookout while Frank engaged in sexual misconduct with women other than his wife. Footnote 214, Conley grilled 5 hours by Luther Rosser, and amazing testimony of Conley marks crucial point of trial. Covering for himself, Rosser said that Frank's character was driven into this case because without such action, Frank had about as much chance as crippled grasshoppers in a pen of doves. Very, very neat figure. The Atlanta Constitution's court reporter seemed bewildered by the famed lawyer's tactic. Quote, he was apparently helping Jim Conley to tell all the damaging evidence he knew in the man whom he accuses of the horrible crime. And just as prosecutors had hoped, Conley uncovered a pattern of planned sexual misbehavior by Frank. Again, he's married during all this. At the factory, that made the state's premeditated liaison motive far more plausible in the jurors' minds. After the noon recess, the judge felt that the testimony was of such a sleazy nature that he cleared the courtroom of all 150 women and teenagers. Conley proceeded to describe sexual acts he had witnessed while being Leo Frank's lookout. Block quote. Frank said, "Of course, you know I ain't built like other men." The reason he said that was, I had seen him in a position I haven't seen any other man that has got children. I have seen him in the office two or three times before Thanksgiving, and a lady was in his office, and she was sitting down in a chair, and she had her clothes up to here, and he was down on his knees, and she had her hands on Mr. Frank. I guess that's oral sex, but I'm not entirely sure about that. I've seen him another time there in the packing room with a young lady lying on the table. She was on the edge of the table when I saw her. Conley impressively one-upped the mighty barrister at every turn and in one instance entirely turned the tables on him. When asked about one of Frank's, quote, chatting, unquote, partners, that was the verb Frank would use for what he was doing with the women that he had Conley guard the privacy of. Do you know who she was? Conley rejoined, I don't know her name, but I know her face, and I know where she lives. Rosser should have been seeking just such an opportunity to trap Conley in a lie. Instead, Rosser beat a fast retreat and changed the subject. It had to be a telling moment for the jury. With Frank's dirty laundry thoroughly aired, Conley was yet able to establish another extremely damaging fact through the bungling barrister Luther Z. Rosser. He asked Conley a simple question. Did you know old man Newt Lee? Conley, no, I didn't know Newt Lee, the night watchman that Frank's team first tried to pin the crime on before it was made impossible, and they turned to trying to frame and blame sweeper Jim Conley. No, says sweeper Conley, Jim Conley. No, I didn't know Newt Lee, the night watchman. I heard them say there was a Negro night watchman, but I never did know that he was a Negro. And with that brow-raising statement, the jury was now free to consider Leo Frank the lone guilty party. For how could Conley have written murder notes describing a man he had never seen? The notes described the lone murderer as the, quote, long, tall, Negro, black, night witch, which even Newt Lee took to mean night watch, and believed to be physically describing him. Frank knew them both, knew their work schedules, and could physically describe them both, knowledge required in order for the murder note's message to be believed. Had Rosser not asked this question of Conley, the assumption that the small group of black employees at the factory all knew one another would have been left undisturbed in the minds of the jury. And with that, Rosser again outwitted himself and pushed his client ever closer to the gallows. Pretty funny, huh? So both Leo Frank and his lawyers were terrible at what they did, basically, even though they were supposedly these super bright fellows. But that's how it is when you have a pretty straightforward case you're trying to lie about. It's not really easy. You're likely to go wrong any which way you go, and even if you don't screw up, you're still pushing something that's extremely improbable to the extent it's beyond reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury, if they're predisposed to be honest about what's going on. But that was not the worst of it. With the murder schematically illustrated for the jurors, Prosecutor Dorsey moved quickly to undergird his Negro testimony with the requisite white support. No sooner did Conley leave the witness stand than a procession of Frank's white female employees testified about their negative personal encounters with their boss, a man they all agreed was possessed of a, quote, bad character, unquote. And they were as forceful as Conley in their allegations, which seemed to verify the persistent rumor that, quote, there was a brothel operating in the basement of the factory, unquote. Frank's lawyers did manage to gain a favorable ruling from Judge Roan that limited the scope and effect of the women's courtroom testimonies, but many of them elaborated unhesitatingly to investigators and to the press before and after the trial. When she tried to visit her sister-in-law at the factory and obtain her pay, Nellie Pettis testified that Frank, quote, told me I couldn't see her until I saw him first. She told how Frank had leered at her, winked at her, pulled a box of money from his desk, and finally asked, what about it? She left his office and his employ, telling Frank to go to hell. As it had been with Mary Fagan, this incident occurred when Pettis was seeking wages, suggesting that Frank saw the weekly payday routine as an opportunity to pressure the young girls into sexual encounters. Later, Frank's detectives and lawyers pushed Pettis to change her testimony, but she refused. And the charges were unrelenting, and all came significantly from white Southern girls about the same age and social class as the murder victim. Murtis Cato, C-A-T-O, swore that she had seen Frank and factory employee Rebecca Carson repeatedly go into the ladies' dressing room and remain there for 15 or 20 minutes. She concluded with a foreboding, that ain't all I know, and that ain't all I saw either. Unquote. Maggie Nash, formerly Griffin, confirmed Cato's story and later swore that one of Frank's hired agents had pressured her to retract her negative assessment of Frank. She told the man he might try 100 years, but she would never do it. And there's inset photos of all these women who testified. Maggie Griffin, Nellie Pettis, Marie Karst, Murtis Cato, Carrie Smith, Nellie Wood, Dewey Hewell, yes, female, and Estelle Winkle. Now, the Southerners are known for the tradition of giving, I think, both girls and boys last names or surnames of relatives they like and respect and want to carry on. So that's how you might get a woman named Dewey. I would surmise. I could be wrong about that, but that tradition exists. And let's see here. Former employee Dewey Hewell traveled from Cincinnati to testify, I have seen Mr. Frank talk to Mary Fagan two or three times a day, even putting, quote, his hand on her shoulder, unquote, and calling her Mary. Mamie Edmonds, formerly Kitchens, says, I was in the dressing room with Miss Irene Jackson when she was undressed. Mr. Frank opened the door and stuck his head inside. He did not knock. He just stood there and laughed. Miss Jackson said, well, we are dressing, blame it. And then he shut the door. Nellie Wood said at the coroner's inquest that Frank had made an indecent proposal to her. He said, you know I'm not like other men, and drawing his chair up closer to me, he says, I don't think you understand me, and put his hands on me, and I resisted, and I got up and opened the door. Under questioning at the coroner's hearing, she went further. Question, do you know Leo Frank? I worked for him for 2 days. Did you observe any misconduct on his part? Well, his actions didn't suit me. He'd come around and put his hands on me when such conduct was entirely uncalled for. Is that all he did? No. He asked me one day to come into his office, saying that he wanted to talk to me. He tried to close the door, but I wouldn't let him. He got too familiar by getting so close to me. He also put his hands on me. Where did he put his hands? He barely touched my breast. He was subtle with his approaches and tried to pretend that he was joking, but I was too wary for such as that. Did he try further familiarities? Yes. When did this happen? 2 years ago. What did you tell him when you left his employ? I just quit telling him that it didn't suit me. Former factory employee Thomas Blackstock had witnessed Frank, quote, picking on factory girls a half dozen times and had heard other complaints around the factory. Ruth Robinson, who had known Mary Fagan as a little girl, testified, Block quote, Mary had worked there a good long time and understood her business. Sometimes Frank would remain at Mary's machine 15 or 20 minutes. I never saw him show that much attention to the work of the other girls on that floor. I've seen Frank, in showing Mary about her work, take hold of her hands and hold them. Frank's visits to Mary and talks with her and assistance given her became more and more frequent. The very last day I worked there, I saw Frank talking to Mary. I heard him call her Mary. So this supposedly smart little Jew is so dumb that he lies that he doesn't know who Mary Fagan is when there's multiple witnesses who can attest they've heard him calling her Mary and seen him with his hands on her and giving her special attention. She further testified that, quote, Frank undertook to give me $7 when he knew I was not entitled to the money, and he endeavored to have an assignation with me sometime the next week. This occurred in his office. The Constitution characterized the testimony of 16-year-old Will E. Turner. Quote, he had seen Frank in conversation with Mary Fagan in the metal room, that the girl was retreating from Frank, and Frank was following her. Frank had said, according to the witness, that he was the superintendent of the factory and wanted to talk to her. The girl had replied that she had some work to do and retreated from him. With every witness, Frank's initial claim not to know Mary Fagan seemed more and more like the evasions of a guilty man. Mertis Cato, Maggie Griffin, C.D. Donegan, H.R. Johnson, Marie Karst, Nellie Pettis, Mary Davis, Mary E. Wallace, Estelle Winkle, Carrie Smith, all witnesses for the defendant, swore similarly that Leo M. Frank's character for lasciviousness was bad. So he's convicted by the testimony of his own defense witnesses. Pretty pathetic. Mary's older sister, as we flip on to 116, reported to the Pinkertons what Mary had confided to her. Quote, Mary had told her about watching the men and women employees of the pencil factory during the dinner hour and stated that Mary had seen men and women hugging and kissing each other in the factory and that couples would try to hide themselves behind boxes and that Mary had looked through the cracks and had seen couples committing fornication and had told her about it on several different occasions. A friend of Mary Fagan's named George Epps told investigators that Mary had expressed to him her fears of Frank's improper advances. Mary's stepfather, J.W. Coleman, revealed, Mary had often said that things went on at the factory that were not nice and that some of the people there tried to get fresh. She told most of these stories to her mother. 13-year-old Grace Hicks claimed that Mary had complained to her that, quote, Leo Frank had put his arm around her and asked Mary if she wanted to take a joyride of heaven, and that Mary Fagan had asked Frank how, to which Frank replied that he would show her someday. Two men, a Grady Kennington and a Mr. V.F. Schenck, claimed that they often saw men and women going into the pencil factory after dark. A man named Mendenhall said that he had heard from a few men working at the factory about several girl employees that Frank had been, quote, familiar with, unquote, but, quote, they were afraid to testify against Mr. Frank. Former employee Paul Whitaker told investigators that he often noticed that when Frank was talking to female employees, quote, seemed to me that Frank rubbed up against them a little too much. A white man named C. Brutus Dalton came forward and testified in support of Conley's story, claiming that he was Frank's co-conspirator in the sexual goings-on at the factory. Now, he's a pretty sleazy-looking fellow, for sure, in the inset photo. Under oath, C. Brutus Dalton said, I have on several visits to Leo M. Frank's office seen Frank with girls in his office, and I have seen Frank play with them, hug them, kiss them, and pinch them. I saw Frank on two or three occasions take a girl and go to the back of the room where the dressing room is. On one occasion, Frank had six bottles of beer, and I carried three more bottles to his office. In regard to the cot in the basement, I know that Leo Frank knew about it because I have heard him speak of it. Conley was sitting at the front door. He said that a former pencil factory worker named Daisy Hopkins had introduced him to Leo Frank and that they all had engaged in immoral behavior. Intending no pun at all, the Constitution called Dalton's testimony remarkably frank. Direct quote. Not all of these unseemly revelations spilled out in the trial, but enough had been disclosed before trial to make the summer of 1913 an extremely hot one for Leo Frank. Despite what appeared to be an insurmountable wall of evidence that supported the testimony of Jim Connolly, Frank nevertheless had reason to feel hopeful. If it could be shown that the testimony of the young girls was in some way corrupted or coached, the charge of sexual deviancy could be shown to be mere vilification. Certainly Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold, two of the greatest cross-examiners in the South, would let none of the alleged seedy pencil factory sexcapades go unanswered. But when their chance came to have at the young women to redeem their client's character, they simply let all the accusations ride unchallenged. Exclamation point. Frank's lawyers sat on their hands, wrote Steve Oney, the Jew writing about this, leaving their client naked in front of an utterly dumbfounded jury. What, you're not going to answer those charges? You must be guilty. Their silence on this most pivotal issue, an issue Frank's attorneys themselves opened up for the court's consideration, could only be taken as verification of the worst of Frank's behavior. See, when you open up something, then the other side is allowed to redress it, you know, through cross-examination or examination. And so you have to be very careful what evidence you introduce and what defendants, what witnesses you produce, because the other side has a chance to get at them. The defense's only response to the veritable mudslide was to move to have all such testimony stricken from the record. Said Rosser, "The fact that Frank might have been frequently guilty of immorality could not be held against him or held as evidence of bad character and reputation. Lasciviousness is not one of the character traits involved in a case of murder." And with that, Frank's attorneys conceded that their client had engaged in sexually deviant behavior. Dorsey's promise to present, quote, "a fearful mass of testimony to prove the perversion of the accused," forced Frank's lawyers into full retreat. Reuben Arnold sheepishly argued to the jury, "We're not trying this case on whether you or I or Frank has been perfect in the past. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." Furthermore, he said, "Frank's behavior was, quote, a sign that we are getting more broad-minded. Deliver me from one of these prudish fellows that never looks at a girl and never puts his hands on her. He's the kind I wouldn't trust behind the door." "Well, you know, so he liked to touch a girl now. Yeah, now he's a good little fellow. He's certainly not a murderer." The lack of any refutation of these white women's testimonies further sensationalized the trial and kept it focused on the sexual nature of the crime. Worse for the defendant, the flood of charges of inappropriate sexual conduct all had been directed at Frank and none at Connolly or Newt Lee or any of the other black employees. And Frank's own hired detectives, the Pinkertons, specifically included in their report that, quote, "Mary Fagan had never mentioned any of the Negro employees at the factory being familiar towards her or taking any liberties." So it's all this ratty little Jew. More charges surface. Other allegations had surfaced that did not make it to trial, but nonetheless circulated widely. A white rooming house owner named Nina Formby, F-O-R-M-B-Y, came forward and swore that Frank was a regular customer of hers, and that he had called her several times on the night of the murder in a panic state seeking a private place for something she knew not what. She claimed in her affidavit and in interviews that Frank even threatened her life when she refused to assist him. She later recanted the story in the press, purportedly claiming that police had, quote, browbeaten, unquote, her and, quote, plied her with whiskey, unquote, until she agreed to this story. But Formby's original affidavit seemed far too detailed to be entirely concocted, and Chief Lanford strongly suggested that he had corroborating evidence from the telephone company's switchboard operators on duty that night. Footnote 249. Frank asked room to conceal body, believes Lanford. Quote, "The apartment house in which she lived was in a locality through which Leo M. Frank passed frequently on his way to work or on his way to visit friends," according to Mrs. Formby. The Washington Post reported that Formby, quote, charged that friends of Frank offered her a large sum to leave Atlanta. She said that when she refused the money, threats were made. And on the same day Forn became forward, a, quote, special policeman, Robert P. House, positively identified Leo Frank as the man he had previously apprehended in the woods with a young girl intent on an, quote, immoral purpose, unquote. He said he had frequently seen Frank entering the private wooded area with a young girl, and this particular time he followed him to a swampy section concealed from view by trees and shrubbery. The Frank team was overwhelmed by and ill-equipped to deal with the prosecution's exposure of Frank's hidden lifestyle. If race is the central fixation of Southern white society, sex is very close second. As more and more of the clandestine sexual aspects of Frank's life were revealed, it seemed certain that, if not murder, Frank had committed yet another serious Georgia crime, sodomy. Again, that means oral as well as anal sex, which at that time carried a penalty of life imprisonment. Obviously, this compounded the challenges facing Frank's legal team. And ends that subsection. There's a couple footnotes. Let's read. Mayor James G. Woodward of Atlanta made that clear in a speech he gave to a San Francisco convention just after Frank's lynching when he cited the protection of white womanhood as justification for Frank's demise. Frank's Jewishness was not a concern for him. The mayor had, in the previous year, addressed the Atlanta Convention of the Grand Lodge of B'nai B'rith, expressing his friendship and pledging himself, quote, to assist the order in any way possible. Frank, convicted of murder and incarcerated at the county jail at the time, was the president of the hosting Atlanta chapter. Well, that's the one worth reading. Next section, Frank Fights Dirty. Epigraph. They say that nigger couldn't lie. Gentlemen, if there is any one thing that nigger can do, it is to lie. Reuben Arnold, Leo Frank's attorney, closing argument. Arnold and Rosser were the main lawyers in this case, both Gentiles used by the team of Jews who funded them. James Jim Conley effectively knitted together the hard facts with a story that struck Atlantans as the first believable explanation of Confederate Day's tragic events. Saturday, April 26, when she was murdered. The pieces of circumstantial evidence Prosecutor Dorsey had assembled now had a narrator, someone who could and did breathe life into the prosecution's theory of the crime. The parade of young white girls onto the witness stand added the mortar and had the subliminal effect of reminding everyone of the travails of murder victim Mary Fagan. It could have been any one of them as just as easily. Assistant Prosecutor Frank Hooper was brimming with confidence and promoting Conley as if he were managing a prize fighter. Quote, Mr. Rosser will go ahead and wear himself out, and Attorney Arnold will hurl questions at Conley until he, too, grows weary. And when it is all over, the Negro will still be there ready for more. The quote-unquote Negro's steadfast adherence to the truth, as he saw it, and his ability when pressed to produce ever more in convincing detail, forced Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold to abandon any judicial decorum and commence a bare-knuckled racist brawl. Thus, for the first time, the Jewish defendant introduced open racial bigotry into the courtroom. Certainly, Conley's rendition had to be refuted, but the Frank team went much further than that. Conley became the channel through which Frank's enormous legal brigade would heap slanderous, Hamitic invective upon the entire black race. And the Ham was the one cursed with a mark on his forehead that's always been used by racist Christians to claim that blacks are essentially natural slaves and natural adherents of the devil, basically. They're naturally an inferior race. And that's what Hamitic means, the adjective. Ham would be the one in the Bible who's the they're placing it sort of the father of the Negro way, race, a low, nasty race. According to one writer, Luther Rosser's courtroom statements about Conley, quote, were the most bigoted utterances made during the case. What Rosser said about Conley, the one guy telling the truth. The silver medal most certainly belonged to Leo Frank's other attorney, Reuben Arnold. And though he endured abuse and savage insults, the Georgian headline told it all. Negro's main story still unshaken. Another announced, Conley's story stands. Another proclaimed, Negro cool and unafraid despite fierce attack of defense on his story. The Atlanta Georgian reporter wrote, one of the three dailies, if the story Conley tells is a lie, then it is the most inhumanly devilish, the most cunningly clever, and the most amazingly sustained lie ever told in Georgia. Said another reporter, if so much as 5% of his story was true, it would suffice to convict Frank. The general belief of Georgians was expressed by Governor John Slayton himself. It is hard to conceive, a direct quote, it is hard to conceive that any man's power of fabrication of minute detail could reach that which Conley showed, unless it be the truth. It was, in the end, an, quote, ingenious narrative, unquote, declared the Atlanta Journal, quote, he, Conley, had every circumstance and feature of this story clear in his mind, and not once during the 16.5 hours that he was in the witness chair did he admit that any portion of it was false, notwithstanding the terrific bombardment of questions hurled at him on cross-examination. But the question which presents itself most persistently is, quote, could this illiterate Negro have conceived and fitted together such a set of detailed circumstances without some foundation in fact? So it's pretty clear he's speaking the truth. The beleaguered defense attorneys, countered by parading dozens of Jewish witnesses, some from Frank's college days, who traveled hundreds of miles to testify to Frank's moral rectitude, so they can produce dozens of Jews who didn't see him do it. But none of them were able to address the specific allegations made by those who saw Frank on a daily basis in his own business environment. Bible-toting Georgians had always held their Jewish neighbors in high regard, and Frank's defense team played to that very fact. So even as they would blame the result on anti-Semitism later, they are deliberately reducing the truth. These idiotic Bible Georgians actually thought Jews were some kind of high and noble race, the opposite of anti-Semites. They were philo-Semites. However, the sentimental advantage his Jewishness offered evaporated in front of a jury that was not so willing to overlook those uncontested sexual allegations. So it's absolutely clear he's a scumbag, and there's no reason to believe he didn't murder the girl as well. It all fits together. He could not overcome the simple fact that, as the Georgian put it, the only testimony pointing toward the innocence of Frank was that of Frank himself. The distressed testimony of Frank's young, white, female employees had the effect of neutralizing the heavy racial overtones of the case. Their word confirmed and superseded that of, quote, the Negroes, numbing the advantage Frank hoped he would have in a Jim Crow courtroom. The B'nai-B'rith president had counted on his ability to portray the sexual assault and murder as a, quote, Negro crime, but with each successive witness testifying to Frank's sexual aggressiveness, the defense's racial tactics looked less and less like a defense and more like an evasion. A footnote here. Assistant Prosecutor Frank Hooper, quote, referred to Frank as a Dr. Jekyll and Edwin Hyde and explained how easy it was for people who saw only one side of him to imagine him a paragon of the virtues. He told of what he termed the man's persistent pursuit of Mary Fagan. He spoke of the discharge of Gant, the only man who knew Mary Fagan at all well, and said this was significant of the man's designs on the girl. Flipping to 124. And there's a graphic, I guess, of a headline. Arnold calls case greatest of frame-ups. Frank prosecuted because he is a Jew, he says to jury. So he's playing on anti-Semitism even during the trial since they have nothing else. Subsection Leo Frank's Negro testimony, quote unquote, and quote unquote Negro crimes. Leo Frank's Negro testimony and Negro crimes. Blah, era epigraphs. I was raised with niggers and know something about them. I do not know them as well as the police, perhaps, for they know them like no one else, but I know something about them. Luther Z. Rosser, Leo Frank's attorney. It's a nigger crime, gentlemen, it's a nigger crime. Reuben Arnold, Leo Frank, so both are using overtly racist hey, he's guilty because he's black. Fuck the specifics. That's all we need to know. That's all you and the jury need to know. This guy's black. He's lying. This is a Negro type crime, a sex crime, a perversion, and a murder. That's what blacks do. That's not an honorable Jew thing. That's a black crime. It's a nigger crime. So if you don't have the facts on your side, just go up to some stereotype generality. Frank had been arrested and charged with the murder of Mary Fagan before Conley's explosive revelations came to light. But Frank's elite attorneys, Herbert Haas, Luther Rosser, and Reuben Arnold, made a calculated decision that their client's fate would hinge on an aggressive introduction of what would generations later become known as, quote, the race card, unquote. This was not a difficult decision in the Deep South, where the deck itself contained nothing but race cards. So when the defenders of the B'nai B'rith president focused their sights squarely on, quote, the Negro, James Conley, it was a natural, even obvious, ploy. In actuality, the racial targeting by the Frank forces began with their merciless scapegoating of Newt Lee, and, before that, with Frank himself when he composed the murder notes, which were intended to lead police to a long, tall, black Negro. And by insisting that the murder occurred in the basement, where the factory's Negro toilet was, Frank was implicitly connecting the crime to black men. The Frank team wanted to capitalize on early reports, like the one in the Atlanta Georgian about a week after the murder, titled, quote, Old Police Reporter Analyzes Mystery. Public suspected Negro. This is a block quote. It was perfectly clear on Sunday and Monday last that the public was willing to put the extraordinary act in the category known as Negro crimes, and the sentiment of the streets was that Lee was guilty or knew the guilty man. That is, the night watchman who discovered he's probably guilty or did it himself or knows who did it. The Fagan case is not a white man's crime, or if it is a white man's crime, it is extraordinary and most unusual. The Frank team relied on the Jewish defendant's status as a privileged white man in a racially divided and racially deluded society. Never before in the Jim Crow South had a black man's testimony been accepted over that of a white man's, and certainly never in the trial of a white man. Footnote 270. Blacks had testified in court before, but were only given credence when it served white interests, such as when it implicated another black person. Quote, under ordinary circumstances, we in the South do not take the word of a Negro against the word of a white man. Frank's attorneys seized upon the state's extraordinary blurring of the color line to make their stand. They looked beyond the murder of Mary Fagan and took the position that Frank's conviction would in fact undermine sacred Southern racial traditions and set in motion a racial upheaval far more significant than Frank's actual guilt or innocence. You're going to destroy Jim Crow if you start listening to black men. Frank's team determined that the very nature of the two races would have to be juxtaposed, just as the 1925 Scopes trial would juxtapose monkey and man in order to suggest the impossibility of a white man as the murderer of Mary Fagan. It was a blatant Jewish appeal to white racial unity. For as one Leo Frank case historian wrote, quote, racial assumptions often acted as the glue that held Southern society together. And in pursuit of that profoundly racist stratagem, Conley and his race became the subject and the focus of a bitter character assassination. It was a racist crusade that began in the courtroom and continued in the Jewish American press and has been carried out for decades hence by pro-Frank historians, journalists, and activists. That is, 100 years after the fact, they're still trying to frame and blame innocent blacks for a crime committed by Jews, as they well know. Frank's defense, in every respect, was shaped to resemble another vital American judicial function in that time. The lynching of black people was an integral part of American culture, largely because it had a unifying effect on the community of lynchers. The pure brutality of it seemed to revive a group hunting instinct among the mobs of whites who participated in these culturally sanctioned human sacrifices. It served both a psychological and a political need to spill the blood of any black intruder on white racial hegemony, and thus kept all blacks terrorized and anchored to their designated place at the basement of American society. Frank's trial lawyers would try to arouse this anti-black fervor in that Georgia courtroom and direct it against the black intruder, James Conley. The first step was to remind Atlantans that white supremacy was the supreme law of the land and a founding principle that was, especially in this case, getting dangerously frayed around the edges. Second, Leo Frank's lawyers reasserted that there was, in fact, and should continue to be, a specific category of evidence known as Negro testimony. This inferior class of evidence had long been recognized in the Southern legal system for the express purpose of devaluing black humanity in the eyes of the law. Footnote 272, worth reading. As a condition of reentry into the Union after the Civil War, all Atlanta city ordinances that discriminated on the basis of race were repealed. But, true to form, blacks were given the right to vote in Atlanta in 1868, the same year the state of Georgia expelled all blacks from its legislature. See Fry and Thompson, The Silent, 62. The Atlanta Georgian reiterated the points that, quote, when a white man's word is brought in combat against a Negro's word, there is no question as to the winner, and that, quote, Negro evidence is as slight as tissue paper. And then again, in the very same New York Times article that reported General O.O. Howard's notification of blacks that, quote, the plantation lands would not be divided among them, it reported that the Mississippi State Legislature, quote, is still engaged in discussing the Negro testimony question. Quote, there is nothing that so shocks the system, unquote, as Negro testimony, wrote Judge John Bell of Tennessee in 1866. And again, in an Alabama case in 1914, the judge stated in open court, quote, quote, I wouldn't believe a nigger any quicker than a pink-eyed rabbit. On appeal, the higher court ruled that the statement was not enough to have prejudiced the jury or to invalidate the trial. So black testimony was little valued. It was looked down upon. Blacks are seen as essentially a race of niggers, a race of scummy liars. That's the basic context and background and social history and general public feeling in which you have Jim Conley testifying against this Jew considered a white. Back to the proper text. This was more than punitive bigotry. It was a fact in how American society financed itself and raised the standard of living for its white citizenry, especially for its wealthiest subgroup, Southern Jews. And they footnote that with a reference to their secret relationship, volume 2, the second volume of their multi-volume series, of which this book is the third, that the Nation of Islam researchers produced using Jewish sources. Such a uniquely American doctrine provided a legal umbrella of protection for every manner of racial wickedness. Merchants could and did cheat blacks at will. Employers could and did refuse to pay them. Bloody violence could be and was perpetrated against blacks. Land, homes, crops, labor, tools, mules could be and were taken from them. All without any legal recourse for the black victims, their testimony in any court completely null and void. This legal, quote, doctrine protected the white rapists of black women and girls whose resulting black children could not not sue for inheritance from their white fathers. The repeal of this incredibly profitable link in the slaves' chains, which is what Frank argued Conley's testimony represented, would usher in an entirely new and disastrous dynamic in race relations. Rabbi Max Heller spoke for the American Jews in their most prominent newspaper, The American Israelite. Quote, one finds it difficult to believe that an intelligent white jury would, unhesitatingly and unqualifiedly, find a verdict of capital punishment against a respectable man upon the virtually unsupported testimony of a low type of Negro. One could not but feel, under the circumstances, that one's faith in American manhood and American civilization would totter. So blacks will have it every which way, no matter whatever it takes, whatever's to their advantage, to get off their own, even if their own is a pedophile murderer and rapist. Thus, Negro testimony had to be dismissed out of hand for no other reason than its dangerous potential to overturn the status quo. Luther Rosser spoke for his client, Leo Frank, at the retrial hearing. Quote, "When has the word of an African been better than the word of one Anglo-Saxon woman? The doctrine that an African's word is more to be relied upon than that of an Anglo-Saxon woman dies with this case." The Constitution, the paper, recorded this part of Rosser's rant, block quote, "They would rather believe the Negro's word. They took it in preference and, in believing it, put the nasty brand of liar on a sweet little white girl." Oh, how times have changed. I hope to God I die before they change any worse than this. And these 12 good men, wrapping their arms lovingly and tenderly around this stinking black brute, saying, "We love you, Jim. We love you." And when whites provided damaging testimony, as did C.B. Dalton, Attorney Rosser performed the obligatory racial damage control. Here is this man Dalton of the Anglo-Saxon race. Yes, gentlemen of the jury, he had a white face, but that was all. He was black within. Obviously, their arguing to exclude testimony by people with black skin put the Jews in the trickiest of moral predicaments. Just a few years into the future, they would rally world outrage on their behalf against the very same alleged discriminations in Nazi Germany. Yet here in an American courtroom, it was Jews who sought to reinforce those very same racist policies for their own behalf. Frank himself voiced his belief that not only was James Conley a liar, but he came from, quote, a lying race, unquote, of people. Quote, "Here is a Negro, not alone with the shiftless and lying habits of an element of his race that is common to the South." What's more, Frank's attempts to reestablish the doctrine of Negro testimony for his Southern interrogators only laid the foundation from which to advance his even more insidious bigotry. The canard that there existed a specific category of transgressions called, quote, Negro crimes, a category into which the murder of Mary Fagan fit neatly and exclusively. A May 31st Atlanta Constitution front page headline, unmistakable in its clear reference to Frank's own thinking, announced, quote, "Mary Fagan's murder was work of a Negro," declares Leo M. Frank. It quoted the B'nai B'rith leader, colon, "No white man killed Mary Fagan. It's a Negro's crime, through and through. No man with common sense would even suspect I did it." Frank's attorney, Reuben Arnold, followed suit, drawing tidy race and class distinctions. Quote, "Why go further than this black wretch there by the elevator shaft, fired with liquor, fired with lust, and crazy for money? Why, they rob and ravish every day in this most peculiar and shocking way. But this man's race," pointing to Frank, "don't kill. They are not a violent race. Some of them may be immoral, but they go no further than that." "Clearly," he continued, "the murder was the unreasoning crime of a Negro," unquote. Arnold declared, "I want to call your attention later to the class of their witnesses and the class of ours. The crime isn't an act of a civilized man. It's the crime of a cannibal, a man-eater. This crime is the hideous act of a Negro who would ravish a 10-year-old girl the same as he would ravish a woman of years. It isn't a white man's crime. It's the crime of a beast, a low, savage beast." With his Jewish client looking on approvingly, Arnold warned his audience of white male jurors about the dangers of black men. Quote, "There are 1,000 of them in Atlanta who would assault a white woman if they had the chance and knew they wouldn't get caught." True. But that doesn't change the facts in this particular case. Flipping on to 130. This approach was calculated to capitalize on the fervor that was then sweeping through the nation, the fear of, quote, Negro domination, unquote. Candidates for titles and positions big and small jousted with each other over who was best qualified to enforce Negro inferiority in all affairs, with particular focus on weakening black voting power. The newspapers were filled with chest-thumping whites waving their curricula vitae, proving who was the quickest to tie a noose around black political and economic progress. Arnold and Rosser easily worked that angle into their defense of Leo Frank. Frank's advocates reached for yet a third distinct layer of race treachery. By the state of Georgia's acceptance of black testimony, they maintained, it turned the Frank from a simple criminal prosecution to an, quote, anti-Semitic persecution. Reuben Arnold, quote, "I'll tell you right now, if Frank hadn't been a Jew, there would never have been any prosecution against him. I'm asking my own people to turn him loose, asking them to do justice to a Jew, and I'm not a Jew, but I would rather die before doing injustice to a Jew." Scholar of the case Leonard Dinnerstein unwittingly confirms this point when he wrote that anti-Semitism in Atlanta, quote, "is evident in the widespread acceptance of Negro Jim Connolly's testimony." Here, even a Jewish scholar writing after the civil rights movement, which was said to have reformed such notions, considers it a sign of anti-Semitism when the civil rights of a black person are respected in an American courtroom. In Dinnerstein's construction, there is no room for the veracity of the black witness or for the fairness of white Gentile jurors and officials. Nor can or should the acceptance of black testimony be seen as a significant breakthrough in American jurisprudence. Nor does Dinnerstein invalidate every previous case in an American courtroom, as Jewish scholars would invalidate any Nazi court proceeding as intrinsically fraudulent. The heretofore immutable principle of white-only testimony, by Dinnerstein's calculation, is a reasonable status quo. The extension of Dinnerstein's argument is that in any instance where, quote, Negro testimony is given any credence in cases affecting Jews, it is by definition anti-Semitism. The key here is Jews play everything all which ways, and always whatever is good for Jews is what determines what angle they take, what lie they tell. And they don't care if they're completely contradictory and spoken within 5 minutes of each other. Whatever is best for the Jew to say at that particular time is what they do. Prominent American Jews with reputations as racial liberals were drawn in to support the racist paradigm of Negro testimony and Negro crimes. Rabbi Stephen Wise, he was the big rabbi of the first 50 years of the 20th century, some call it communism, I call it Judaism, probably his most famous quote, of New York. Rabbi Stephen Wise of New York was one of the foremost Jews in America and a supporter of the NAACP. In reference to the Frank case, Wise insisted that crimes against women are, quote, rarely, if ever, unquote, committed by Jews, an assertion intended to mean, of course, that such outrages are common to other races, namely James Connolly's race. Ironically, Jews were at that moment the undisputed masters of the international prostitution trade known as white slavery. Frank's defense team had bared their teeth and let loose a blistering barrage of racial invective. With Frank looking on, Rosser called Connolly a dirty nigger and a disreputable Negro ex-convict, and referred to him as bestial and filthy, all these direct quotes, and a savage and a brute. Reuben Arnold went beyond individual black witnesses before him and asserted, quote, "Every Southern man knows that Negroes can make up gruesome stories." Connolly, he said, was, quote, "a perpetual lawbreaker who has a lawbreaking race back of him." In reference to the murder notes found next to Mary Fagan's body, Arnold raged, quote, "These notes are Negro notes from beginning to end, in thought, in composition, in everything. The savage mind acts in strange, devious, peculiar ways. The educated mind does not. They are idiotic and ridiculous, except to an ignorant, darkened mind. Here we have a note so obscure, so couched in the dark vernacular of the Negro. He says it was all dictated by Frank, too, that our Southern policemen who corral these Negroes daily, who deal with them and who play with them like you would with cards on a table, can't understand it. Everyone is groping in the darkness until Newt Lee sees it. Newt Lee, a Negro whose mental operations are the same as Jim Connolly's. A white man goes by his intelligence, by his logic, by his discernment. A Negro goes largely by his instinct, and occasionally it is strikingly correct." And thus the Negro notes led ipso facto to the Negro crime. Quote, "Well, the little girl Mary entered, and she got her pay and asked about the medal, and then she left, but there was a black spider waiting down there near the elevator shaft, a great, passionate, lustful animal. He was as full of vile lust as he was of passion for more whiskey." Connolly was not shown to have been drunk on the day of the murder, and in light of the testimony from his cook, Mrs. Manola McKnight, and his friend, Mr. C. Brutus Dalton, inebriation seemed more descriptive of the defendant, Leo Frank. Nor is there any testimony that Conley ever used cocaine, yet the venerable Luther Z. Rosser declared, quote, "Is it possible that you Anglo-Saxon men have forgotten the nature of the Negro? Conley is a plain, beastly, ragged, filthy, lying nigger." Have I overstated that? Conley is a plain, dirty, filthy, lying, drunken, and probably lousy nigger that is full of lice. They got a dirty black Negro, and in order to give impetus to his testimony, they had a barber cut his hair and shave him, and they gave him a bath, and he came in here like a slicked onion. Whoever played that trick was unworthy of the name white man. Why didn't they let you see him as he was, with his spreading nose, through which probably tons of cocaine had been sniffed? I mean, goddamn. There were some racist motherfuckers back then. I mean, that is just totally, they are totally, totally slurring the character of this guy, sleazing him up. I mean, goddamn. Spreading nose through which probably tons of cocaine have been. I mean, son of a bitch. That is above and beyond. Now, there's actually a long footnote here that might be worth reading a little bit of. The Samuelses, Nightfell, 158, noted that the men defending Frank, while protesting the prejudice against Jews, saw no reason why anyone should object to their own often expressed prejudice against Negroes. See also, Rosser makes great speech for the defense. Consider the language used in an Atlanta Constitution article by Britt Craig. Break in the Frank trial may come with a hearing of Jim Conley's testimony from August 3, 1913. In describing the, quote, bath given to James Conley, a 27-year-old black man, and whether the actions ascribed to the police could ever have been visited upon Leo Frank, a Jew, quote, still all in the footnote, it's a ways to go. They took him into the backyard where nobody could see, it is said, and turned a liberal hose upon him. They scoured and scraped and scoured and scraped and had him as shiny as the brass trimmings on a 1914 model auto. Then they took him back into the prison and sicked a Negro barber on him. The barber shaved his head and his face until it was as slick as an egg. Within just a few years, one of the leaders of Jewish organized crime, Arnold Rothstein, would be credited by the United States government with being the sole source of imported narcotics in America. CUS Senate organized, blah, 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 blah. Quote, "The Jewish racketeers of New York almost exclusively controlled narcotics, but back in the 1920s, the leader at that time was Arnold Rothstein." Robert A. Rockaway, hoodlum hero, the Jewish gangster as defender of his people, American Jewish History, 82, numbers 1 to 4, 1994, 95, 215. Quote, "During Prohibition, in effect from 1920 to 1933, 50% of the leading bootleggers were Jews, and Jewish criminals financed and directed much of the nation's narcotics traffic. Jews also dominated illicit activities in a number of America's largest cities, including Boston, Cleveland, Detroit, Minneapolis, New York, and Philadelphia. The charge against Conley as being a cocaine user is unproved and unsubstantiated, but there is important context to this issue provided by Adolf Ox, the Jewish owner of the New York Times." Quote, "The use of coke is probably much more widely spread among Negroes than among whites. Heaven dust, they call it. Its use by Negro field hands in the South has spread with appalling swiftness and results. There's little doubt but that every Jew peddler in the South carries the stuff, although many states have lately made its sale a felony." Back to the main text. So that's some of the context there. Again, buy this book if you want from the Nation of Islam. Don't buy it from the Jew Bezos at Amazon, who publishes the lying, lie-filled, anti-white Washington Post. Buy it from the Nation of Islam. Yeah, it's true they claim whites were created in a test tube by mad scientist Yaka, but you know what? That's still more tolerable than the nasty kikes. And when Conley did not recall whether he had finished his breakfast on a day 4 months before, Luther Rosser snorted, "Don't you know a nigger never had sausage on the table without eating it? Sneering at Conley, he fumed. They put some clean clothes on you, didn't they, so the jury could see you like a dressed-up nigger. He turned to the jury and summed up their task. Quote, that white men should believe this infamous character, Jim Conley, is a shame on this great city, in this great state, and will be so to the end of time. And though the Georgian reported that Luther Rosser referred to Conley with unsparing epithets, the Jewish defendant, quote, shook hands with Rosser warmly and congratulated him upon his speech. Night watchman Newt Lee was exonerated of any role in the crime, but Frank's team, throughout the trial and long after, continued to insist that Lee had played some part in the murder. They had even planted a bloody shirt in his home to help the investigation along. Luther Rosser, in referring to the characteristics of that bloody shirt, had this exchange with a medical expert in open court. Question, the shirt had the odor of blood on it when you first got it, didn't it? Answer, yes. Then wouldn't the odor of blood have killed the odor of nigger? Answer, no. Question, then if a nigger had just put on his shirt and had taken it off in an instant, your nose would get him? Have you ever smelled a negro, Mr. Rosser? Rosser, more than you ever smelled. I was smelling them before you were born, son. I threw in the son, but that's freaking hilarious. That's how it was in court back then. Today we have to have cops on trial who apologize for shooting guilty nigger criminals. You know, just amazing how things human can flip and do a 180 in a short time. As president of B'nai B'rith, Leo Frank was arguably the most important Jew in Georgia, yet his courtroom defense would become one of the most racist ever recorded in the history of the American judicial system. And whilst scholars have insisted that anti-Semitic lynch mobs were lusting for the blood of the Jewish Leo Frank, the incredible fact is that Frank himself was quite willing to stoke a racial climate so dangerous and volatile that the white Gentile mayor of Atlanta had to take special measures to prevent the black man's lynching. Jeffrey Melnick said that the Frank team waged a virulent racist offensive, and their attempts to vindicate Frank, he wrote, ultimately validated the process of racial scapegoating itself. Their raging about black beasts, rapists, and other vicious stereotypes, quote, became a familiar feature of pro-Frank discourse. They, quote, capitalized on much the same sort of racist thinking that helped to turn the public opinion against their man. The supporters of Leo Frank proved willing to employ racist thinking to condemn Jim Conley while often simultaneously decrying the similar sentiments that contributed to Frank's conviction. Theodore Rosengarten lamented, quote, readers who wish to find a progressive Jewish social ethic at work in the Frank camp will be sorely disappointed. Frank's lawyers played the race card for all it was worth because they didn't have the facts, so they used racism against blacks. They used anti-black sentiment. Legitimate enough, certainly, but inapplicable to this case because the black guy was telling the truth. Next subsection, I think the last one of this particular session, Leo Frank takes the stand. Block quote, like a dull knife just ain't cutting, just talking loud and saying nothing. I guess that's a James Brown lyric. The jury, now awash in the unseemly realities of Leo Frank's private life, so up front, he's a respectable businessman, head of an important company that employs a lot of people, and he's head of the B'nai B'rith, which attests to his social standing and his respect among not just Jews down south in Atlanta, but whites who regard, if anything, are philo-Semitic in relation to Jews in general. So that's the surface, Leo Frank. The subsurface, hidden Leo Frank, is that he is married but carries on loads of adulteries with any kind of white women he can find. He literally is out in the swamp screwing various girls, and he has assignations within his factory. He's constantly hitting on them and being very immoral. And back then, that was taken a good deal more seriously, not just socially, but legally, than it is today. You heard us say that sodomy could be a life imprisonment. The sentence for sodomy was life imprisonment, for Christ's sakes. The jury, now awash in the unseemly realities of Leo Frank's private life, anticipated an explanation directly from the man himself. And on August 18th, The defendant took the stand in his own defense, but he did so under a strange anomaly of Georgia law that made him impervious to cross-examination. So this guilty little kike doesn't want to face any questions. And Georgia law has an odd loophole that allows that. Under the law, a, quote, prisoner, unquote, had the right to make a statement in court, but he would not have to be sworn on the Bible or cross-examined by the prosecutor. In effect, Frank would be able to say anything to the jury on any topic. He would not even have to speak about the case at all. And prosecutor Hugh Dorsey would have no role except as a spectator. Very bizarre, isn't it? Footnote 304. The statute in the Georgia Code, 38-415, enacted for that purpose, provides, quote, in all criminal trials, the prisoner shall have the right to make to the court and jury such statement in the case as he may deem proper in his defense. It shall not be under oath, and shall have such force only as the jury may think right to give it. They may believe it in preference to the sworn testimony in the case. The prisoner shall not be compelled to answer any questions on cross-examination should he think proper to decline to answer. Now, how that came about, I have no idea, but it's interesting, and I guess other states don't have it like that, but Georgia did. Nonetheless, on August 17th, the Georgian gave the event advance billing, posting a big banner headline, Leo Frank is ready to reveal his story. Quote, what this statement will be, the defendant's lawyers themselves profess not to know, though Frank's attorneys informed the press that he had been preparing his statement since the trial began. The Georgian expected that Frank would, quote, appeal to the reason and common sense of the 12 men. And though the newspaper sympathetically reported that he, quote, made his own best witness, that sentiment turned out to be woefully optimistic. On top of page 137, in the 4 hours of his exhaustively rehearsed monologue, Frank approached his last opportunity for redemption in a most curious manner. With all ears open to him as never before, he treated Atlanta to a litany of technocratic details about his daily work routine, giving a bare minimum of attention to the capital murder charge against him. He took the jury through the eye-glazing, mind-numbing details of factory management and administration, point by tedious point, a sample of which follows. And this is fairly long. This is Leo Frank in his statement, what he chooses to talk about. He's accused of murder, and he's had a parade of girls attesting to his immoral behavior, and this is how he chooses to answer. Leo Frank, quote, of all the mathematical work in the office of the pencil factory, this very operation, this very piece of work that I have now before me, is the most important. It is the invoice covering shipments that are sent to customers, and it is very important that the prices be correct, that the amount of goods shipped agrees with the amount which is on the invoice, and that the terms are correct, and that the address is correct, and also in some cases, I don't know whether there is one like that here, there are freight deductions, all of which have to be very carefully checked over and looked into, because I know of nothing else that exasperates a customer more than to receive invoices that are incorrect. Moreover, on this morning, this operation of this work took me longer than it usually takes an ordinary person to complete the checking of the invoices, because usually one calls out and the other checks, but I did this work all by myself that morning, as I went over these invoices, I noticed that Miss Eubanks, the day before, had evidently sacrificed accuracy to speed, and every one of them was wrong, so I had to go alone over the whole invoice, and I had to make the corrections as I went along, figure them out, extend them, make deductions for freight, if there were any to be made, and then get the total shipments, because when these shipments were made on April 24th, which was Thursday, this was the last day of our fiscal week, it was on this that I made the financial sheet, which I make out every Saturday afternoon, as has been my custom. It is on this figure of total shipments I make that out, so necessarily it would be the total shipments for the week that had to be figured out, and I had to figure every invoice and arrange it in its entirety so I could get a figure that I would be able to use. The first order here is from Hilton, Hart, and Kern Company, Detroit, Michigan. Here is the original order, which is in the file of our office. Here is the transcription, which was made on March 28th. It hadn't been shipped until April 24th. This customer ordered 100 gross of number 2 of a certain pencil stamped, the Packard Motor Car Company. 125 gross of number 3 and 50 gross of number 4. Those figures represented the grade or hardness of the lead in the pencils. We shipped 100 gross of number 2, 111 and a quarter gross of number 3, and 49 gross of number 4. The amount of the shipment of number 3 is short of the amount the customer ordered. Therefore, there is a suspense shipment card attached to it. As you will notice, the shipment on this order took place on April 24th. It was a special order and a special imprint on it, and therefore the length of time order received at the factory on March 18th. So he's spurging out on pencil company management details. That, dude, what about the murder? Frank continued as though he believed he was addressing a pencil manufacturer's trade conference. He even brought in a sample case of his pencil product line for the jury to see. What he had intended to accomplish by this long-winded industry exegesis is one of the enduring mysteries of the case. Indeed, the description of young Frank by his four-year college classmates in his 1906 Cornell senior class yearbook was no less than prophecy. Quote, and there's an inset graphic, the Cornell class book. Leo Max Frank hails from sleepy Brooklyn, famed for graveyards, breweries, and baby carriages. Blossoming in the cotton fields of Texas and finding southern life too easy, he migrated to New York's slumberland. The far-famed beauty of Ithaca's scenery induced him to choose Cornell as his alma mater. His genius found expression in the three-phase generators and foundry work, where he soon gained the reputation of being the champion hot air artist of the university by his happy faculty of talking all day and saying nothing. His services as a debating coach for the Congress debate teams have made him a fame hard to equal. This proficiency as an air shooter will doubtless win Max success as a gas jet. This is kind of how they did yearbooks back in the day, kind of ironical, kind of mocking of the various people, and they found him, he was a hot air bullshit artist type, Leo Frank, and he was an engineer at Cornell or studied engineering. And so, indeed, the description of young Frank by his four-year college classmates was no less than prophecy, quote, his, Leo Max Frank's genius found expression in three-phase generators and foundry work, where he soon gained the reputation of being the champion hot air artist of the university by his happy faculty of talking all day and saying nothing. His services as a debating coach for the Congress debate teams have made him a fame hard to equal. This proficiency as an air shooter will doubtless win Max success as a gas jet. That's from the class book, Cornell University, class of 1906, page 79. Flipping on to the second to last page, 139. To be generous, part of his defense relied on the notion that on that Saturday afternoon, Frank was simply too busy preparing complex business reports to commit the murder and the cover-up. His approach seemed designed to establish that point, but every administrative detail Frank felt the jurors should know seemed only to reinforce their view that he either was deluded about the actual purpose of the trial, or he was attempting to conceal his guilt in a barrage of minutiae calculated to belittle or overwhelm their intelligence. And yet he pressed on in that same self-destructive vein. Jeffrey Melnick is one of many scholars who considered Frank's statement damaging to his case. Quote, and when he does take the stand, I've read the whole speech and it's gruesome. What Frank decided to focus on, a terrible mistake he made in his own case, that he thought what was called for was to talk about the financial workings of the factory. According to the Anti-Defamation League's internal analysis, quote, his four-hour appearance in the witness stand was disingenuous in the extreme. Footnote 308. DeWitt H. Roberts, Anti-Semitism in the Leo M. Frank Case, unpublished essay of the ADL, not from 1953, SC-3576, American Jewish Archive, Cincinnati, Ohio. And the ADL assessed his witness stand performance as, quote, marked by a factual error, Frank's statement that the noon whistle blew, that completed the case against him. The whistle is significant because Saturday was a holiday, so the factory's manually operated noon whistle did not blow, though Frank continued to insist that it did and to base his time estimates on the phantom whistle. And back to the text, Steve Oney. By 4:35, when Judge Roan ordered a brief recess, Frank had been ratcheting on for the better part of 2.5 hours. And while he may have convinced some of those listening that the work he'd done on the financial sheet the afternoon of the murder demanded intense concentration, it's doubtful he persuaded anyone to the related conclusion that he was guiltless. Indeed, the more probable reactions were suspicion and disbelief. Here was a man who, for all his reliance on the precise language of management, seemed to be manifesting a kind of hysteria. Had Frank ended his statement at this juncture, there can be little doubt that it would have been judged an unmitigated disaster. Flipping on to 140. Last page. When he did finally focus on the events surrounding the murder, Frank offered no more about his own actions than was already asserted in his pre-trial statements, all of which professed absolute ignorance of any aspect of Mary Fagan's demise. So he's saying, I'm a didn't-do-nothing, completely. He denied any improper behavior with the factory's female employees or any engagement in after-hour adulteries. He denied, quote, the Negro Conley statement, unquote, or that he had even seen Conley on the day of the murder. And when he had the opportunity to subject himself to questioning as, quote, the Negro Conley, unquote, had, Leo Frank declined. As he left the stand, the handwriting was on the wall. August 25th marked the end of Leo Frank's month-long trial for the murder of Mary Fagan. It took jurors just a few hours to return a guilty verdict in a case that could only be described as a total legal disaster for Leo Max Frank. The weight of the evidence, the inconsistencies in Frank's alibi, James Conley's unshakable testimony, the wave of unchallenged victims of Frank's sexual harassment, Frank's refusal to be questioned or to offer any alternative explanation of the crime, convinced a 12-man jury of fellow white men not only that he was guilty of murder, but that he ought to die. The next day, August 26, 1913, Judge Leonard S. Roan sentenced Leo M. Frank to hang for the murder of Mary Fagan. The execution date was set for October 10, 1913. And that's the end of this section that we're going to do, and this session that we're going to do today. So think about just an interesting fact that, so he commits the crime on April 26th, and then May, June, July, August. 4 months later to the day, he is convicted and sentenced to hang, or at least sentenced to hang 4 months to the day. That is speedy justice. And again, this was not a small or medium trial. This was the biggest trial in Georgia state history, and the whole thing is wrapped up. All this coverage and all these witnesses and the length of the trial, it's all wrapped up in 4 months. And they got the right result. I thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up more of the Leo Frank case, the lynching of a guilty man by the Nation of Islam.